But there's going to be a whole bunch of applications that are going to emerge in the next few years. Like, it's happening incredibly quickly right now. 1,000 new, you know, startups trying to use large language models for all kinds of verticals where they've never been thought of before. If you can find a data set, you go and train it and see if that's a cool thing. And then what do you need to do to turn it into a product?
To Startupville, the show where we discuss the growing technology and research sector in Saskatchewan, Canada. I'm your producer, Ariel Delorier. Our host is Mike Wolsfeld, and today we're joined by a returning guest and local legend, Jeff Dick with Siemens EDA. Jeff is the first guest joining us in our brand new podcast recording studio inside Collider, the new co-working hub at the Research and Technology Parks in Saskatoon and Regina. We chat with Jeff about his professional journey, how Siemens EDA has more than 10x their growth since we chatted with them years ago, and many other exciting tech topics like the future of artificial intelligence, how to maintain startup growth, and creating a company culture where employees want to come into the office. Welcome to Startupville. The Startupville podcast is brought to you by Innovation Saskatchewan.
All right, we're here with Jeff Dick on the Startupville podcast. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Here we go again.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you back here. I think you were on the very first episode of Startupville way back in 2018.
Yeah, I think with Jordan.
Yeah. And we've had you back, I think, again in the pandemic to talk us through some of the issues there. And now we're heading into a whole different kind of era of the tech sector here. And it's great to have you back to catch up and hear your thoughts on things. So, to get things started, some of our viewers are already very familiar with you and the Solido story and Siemens now. But I'd love to just dive into a bit of the Coles notes on, you know, your history in the tech sector here, with Solido and the acquisition of Siemens and where you're at now.
Yeah, that sounds really good. So Coles notes, I mean, I go back a ways further than that. I worked in custom software in the late 90s, early 2000s, led up about 150 custom software projects, did some work with Modern Digital Communications, which was another innovation place, Innovation Saskatchewan tenant, and that one got acquired back in 2003 or 2004 or something. And I was doing, you know, server architectural design work and then Solido started in 05. I joined in 06 and I ran, product and R&D basically, and kind of helped build, that company from, you know, having a little bit of venture money into something that was sort of scaling. So the way that Solido worked was, we entered into the semiconductor space with kind of a thesis that we were going to solve manufacturing variation problems, which are getting harder. You know, process nodes are shrinking. Manufacturing process variation was becoming a bigger problem that needed to be solved at design time. And we took a couple kicks at the can, kind of got it wrong with the first product. You know, talked to customers a lot, big ears. We worked really, really quickly delivering things that our customers told us that they wanted to pay us for. And, our first invention that was really differentiated was in 2008. It was something called High Sigma Monte Carlo. And it was you know, completely revolutionary, solved a problem like a million times faster than it had ever been solved before. And really, you know, made this, you know, foundation for building more stuff. Customers loved it. They were buying it. And then that kind of gave us, you know, the funding to build more stuff. And we basically bootstrapped from that point on, built a number of additional products and then got acquired in 2017 by Siemens. So Siemens is a beast. You know, we went from a 65 person company at acquisition to, 300 and some thousand person company, all of a sudden. And that was, you know, a little bit of culture shock, but they're really good at buying companies. They bought over 2,800 companies over the years, 175 years, they've acquired 2,800 companies. And, you know, one of the things that they learned is to leave them alone, right? You know, just we bought a good company, don't break it. And they told us, be who you are. We bought you because we like you. Be who you are. And so it was kind of a gradual integration process, and it's gone extremely well. I think, you know, our revenues are up by about a dozen times since acquisition, over 5 years. Incredible growth rate, and we've been, you know, sort of building up the number of pieces that we manage through our organization as well over time. So it's been fun. It's been a fun run.
That's awesome. So yeah, you continued to grow a lot since the acquisition.
Yeah.
especially in a time right now where every other day it seems you see news from some big tech layoff. Siemens is one of the biggest of big tech, and you guys are still growing. You said 12 times since you got acquired. What are some of the secrets of maintaining that startup level growth at that scale?
Yeah, it's tricky. You know, it's easy to double when you're early, you know, and like, you know, $1 is infinitely more than $0, and, you know, 2 million is double what 1 million is. But none of those are, you know, you're not done yet. You're just barely getting started. And, you know, keeping the growth rate year on year is really challenging, because if you just keep doing the same thing, it's going to saturate, right? You're building the same thing. You've hit the market. You found product market fit. You scale it up and then you reach the saturation point. There's nothing left to sell. So one of the key things is you need to keep finding new things to sell to your customers, right? So how do I sell? There's a few different ways to scale. I'm talking about revenue. There's definitely an operational side to this too, but, you know, can I sell more of my product to, you know, within the organization, if I go talk to more groups, you know, maybe add some features to increase its applicability to the market. So that's just, you know, a quantity thing. You can also upsell. So is there, you know, some features that I can add that I can charge more for, you know, premium tier, an advanced tier, an add-on, stuff like that. And then there's sort of this question, is there something completely different that I could build where I have a market adjacency? Maybe it's the same customers buying a different product from you, but I've already got this in, you know, we're working with customers. And so you solve a new class of problem, bring a new product to market, and then you cross sell that in. So that's really, you have to have more things. We can also buy companies, right? So if you find a piece that fits nicely with the organization, with what we're doing, we can buy a piece and then offer that. And Siemens got an incredibly good sales platform. We have deals with every customer. It's easy to introduce. I mean, it's never easy, but it's a lot easier to take something that already has some product market fit and then just blast it out, you know, through our channel. So that's another way to win. So we've introduced a lot of new products in the last 5 years. Are extremely active. My R&D team has 350 software developers on it now. So it's quite large. We have a lot of capacity to do new things. The hardest part is really making sure that you're doing the right things for your customers. You know, what problem do our customers want to pay us to solve next? And making sure that the roadmap's very, very carefully targeted toward things that we're ultimately going to be able to sell reliably, have a hit-making kind of formula that's repeatable. And that's gone quite well. I think that's probably the real magic, is knowing how to identify things customers will pay for, execute on it quickly, move on to the next thing, keep hiring as we're going, you know, keep scaling up as we're going, so we never get stuck. You know, there's a lot of pieces there, I think, but that gives a bit of the high level maybe about what keeps the growth driver, it keeps growth happening at a larger scale.
And there's a key repeated theme there that I've heard you talk about a lot, and it sounds very simple. Yeah. Build things people are willing to pay you for.
Yeah.
But it actually it's not really that simple for a lot of people. It can be really challenging, and even, you know, it can be hard enough for early stage founders where it's basically one to one, the people talking to the customers and building the product and having that direct connection. That's hard enough. I'd love to dive into more on how you've created this machine of building things that people are willing to pay for when it's no longer just the founders sort of driving that innovation, and you're building that culture within a larger organization, and then perhaps being able to leverage other teams in different ways, right? Where you're leveraging sales in a different way to give you new insights and data and whatnot. I'd love to learn more about how you've created a machine of building things that people want to pay for.
Yeah. I mean, a big part. So part of it too is as you're scaling, you got to solve, you know, higher bounty problems. You know, it used to be, you know, in the early days, if we could find a way to add $1 million ARR, that was a big deal. And it's 10 million. Now it's an order of magnitude higher that's moving the needle. So, you know, what's the next big thing that's going to move the needle relative to where we are? So it's important to keep thinking larger as we go. It isn't really that the whole organization knows how to do this. I wouldn't say it's necessarily a culture thing, but it's rather, you develop a reputation within your key customers for being able to take on things that are hard. And then they give you like, oh, wow, hey, you did a good job of that last one. Let me give you something that's bigger, you know, to try. And I'm talking about, you know, working with the big customers in the space. So we work with all tier one semiconductor companies as the big drivers. We're not asking small companies, what do you want to pay us to solve next? It's sort of an ongoing discussion is how I'd characterize it, with people that really trust us. You know, we did a good job on the last one and the last one before that. And then they give you a bigger bounty problem. And they get comfortable with that. They know that you're the right organization that can take that on. So that's a big part of it. It's actually gets harder in that tight little phrase, you know, solve problems that customers are willing to pay for. There's two pieces. First of all, you have to figure out what the technical problems are. You know, so working with key technologists there, figuring out what feels like, you know, hey, that one feels like a big problem, and it's probably not just you that has it. You know, that kind of, you get a feel for that. But then also the paying part. Not every problem is one that people pay you to solve. So that's really hard, you know, sort of coming up with a vision for what the solution's going to be, running it up the purchasing chain, both on our side, you know, through our account teams and through, you know, customer sign-off and purchasing before you even build it. You know, that gets more complicated. There's a lot more people involved in that as you scale up. It's not less people. You know, as you get closer to the top, it gets to be more people actually, which is, you know, counterintuitive, but you get these big teams that are working on accounts and big teams working on purchasing and bigger decisions have more people and more layers of decision-making. So getting really good at navigating that is one of the hardest parts. While also, you know, you discover the technical problems, you navigate the purchasing problem, and you make sure that you're kind of co-solving the technical and business problem together, then you, hey, I know this is the right one, I'm going to go pick it. The second part is you want to make sure that it's not a problem that only one customer has. There's lots of things where, hey, I've got this thing, it's not solved. Okay, great. I wonder if we do it for you, if we can sell it elsewhere. So I like rules of three in terms of, you know, when we're talking about the top 20, there's only 20 customers in the top 20. It's easy to go and talk to some of them and figure out what's representative. But I like to have three early adopters that say, if you build this, we'll buy it for a price that's reasonable. And, you know, usually, you know, if you do a good job of that, you can find things that can be, you know, profitable in the first year with those first few customers, then you go sell it to the other 17. The reason I talk about the top 20 all the time is because in our space, the top 20 spends most of the money in the whole industry. There's hundreds of companies, but the top 20 spends most of the money. So if you can find stuff that you can sell to the top 20, it's basically the name of the game. And we get good at that. And we get good at, you know, really looking after our customers and making sure that we deliver, you know, on time and that we've got quality solutions, best support in the industry. And then they keep, you know, letting you kind of move to the next level with them and solve the next big problem.
Yeah. So it's a big trust aspect.
You got it. Yeah. Yeah. Trust is a big part. Being innovative too. Usually they don't bring you problems that are easy to solve. It's sort of like, you know, here's a big one that we couldn't figure out. And, you know, these top 20 semiconductor companies have a lot of in-house capability. If it was easy, they would have solved it themselves. So they want someone that can do large projects, but also, you know, kind of think out of the box and come up with, you know, very different solutions than they've ever seen before. They're building chips today. They've solved this some other way in the past, but it's not good enough. And they're coming to you because they want something better.
So solving problems that nobody else could solve and solving them better. So I'd love to dive in a little bit more of that in terms of Siemens and, you know, where you're headed here in terms of your presence in Saskatchewan, the teams you have here. And, you know, what are the things that kind of excite you the most about what you've been working on with your teams here and where sort of Siemens and Siemens in Saskatchewan is headed?
Yeah, so Siemens is a huge international company. I think, you know, I heard that we have 6,600 offices or something worldwide. We're everywhere. My team's in, I just did a count, it's in 24 cities now, right? So it's not just in Saskatoon. Yeah. It's, and some of them are just, you know, there's one remote worker there, but some of them are substantial presences. Like I've got a big team in Cairo, Egypt, and a big team in Noida in India, a couple of big teams in the States, and in Grenoble, France, we've got a substantial team there. And what's special about Saskatchewan, I think, is and this is where Solito started, right? Solito was a Saskatchewan. We only had a team in Saskatchewan. We had, you know, a few salespeople that were elsewhere, but we were under one roof. And the team here, almost everybody that we had, you know, right from the early days is still with us, which is incredible. So our very first hire was Chris Breen at Salida. He was the first employee. He's still here. The second hire was Jan Dongay. So Chris is actually, he's director of our applications engineering team. Jan Dongay is like a, you know, one of the most senior applications engineers that we've got in the whole organization. And he's awesome. He kind of looks after a lot of our Asia Pac customers, and he's still here. Joel Cooper, his name's on probably half of our patents. You know, he's one of our key inventors. He was the third hire for Salido, and he's still here, and he's still driving a lot of the coolest, hardest technology projects that we have. So there's a sense of camaraderie that we have in this team here. There's some magic, I think, and a real bond within this team. One thing that's been really nice is, it used to be kind of a little tricky to scale because there weren't a ton of software developers around. But, you know, the university's been producing a lot more software developers. There's going to be about 300 students graduating this year, which is incredible. I think in 2008 or something like that was a low. There was like 16 students that graduated from computer science, hardly any. Now we're up at 300. So, you know, there's definitely more output of talent, which is great. Engineering department's doing a great job too of producing talent. So we can actually scale quite a bit here. You know, it's you worry like how much can we actually do in one location? You know, we're a mid-sized city, so you can't put everything here and scale here forever, but we can actually do more as we're producing more talent. And I feel like we've made really good progress there. I do think that we've got a really unique ability to onboard people here too. So we've got a great onboarding program in our Saskatoon office. We have a thing that we call the incubator. We called it that before. I think there were startup incubators. We just called it. It was like a dozen years ago. That was our name for it. It's where people start for their first 30 days. There's a guy named Anthony Ho who's been running that since the very beginning, pretty much. And so you spend your first 30 days with someone that's onboarded like well over 100 software developers and knows how to do it. Then we've got this mentorship program. It's all very much in person. Like a lot of it's in person. You get assigned a mentor in your first month and you sort of spend your next 6 months or year with that person, you know, and we teach our mentors how to be good mentors. And there's this outstanding ability to onboard talent. That's what it's all about. When you're in a specialized area like us, we can't just go hire people and they sit down, they know what to do. It takes quite a while to produce talent, and we're very good at it here, and people really like working together. So there's sort of this magic here where we can really reliably recruit new hires fresh out of school. We can onboard them and they really bond with this already bonded team. We tend to have excellent retention. So talent and retention is what it's all about when you're doing something that requires a lot of specialized skill like we have to develop. I don't know if that's part of it. You know, I think that's something special in Saskatchewan for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm always amazed at how so many different aspects of your business are all working together to create that sort of retention algorithm and the success rate that you've had in terms of the amount of people who are still with the company that have been with the company for a long time. But when you look at everything that you guys do, right down to how your space is engineered, to how you onboard people and how you build culture with the team, and it's sort of, you know, there's a lot of friends within the Siemens team, right? Yep. I'm always impressed with how well you've been able to do that for how long. And the numbers speak for themselves.
Yeah, and it's been tricky. It's different when you've got, you know, a dozen person team. I mean, they kind of bond. If they're all under one roof, you know, it's pretty easy to make friends and to make it feel like, you know, you've got this bonded team. But how do you do that at scale? How do you do that when it's 10 times bigger in the same location? Especially when we've sent a bunch of people home for a while, or, you know, we're not bringing them back, but they're coming back. You know, that's what's happened. We've told people, hey, here's what you need to get done. Make sure you're in the right place to do it. You figure it out. Not a whole lot of hard rules or anything, no hard rules on that stuff. But people are coming back, and our office is looking fairly busy these days. We just added another floor, actually, so doubled up our space in Saskatoon. And the fourth floor, people are so excited to move in. Networking wasn't even up yet on Friday. It's supposed to be almost done or finishing today or something. And people are all moving in, and it's like pretty much populated. Like I think a lot of people are really, really want to be in the office, because it's not because people love offices, right? We've seen this big movement away from the office. And, you know, but Saskatoon's kind of special. The commute's really short, you know, Tucson commute or whatever it is. I think that's the tagline, right? Tucson commute here. So people can come in. It's really easy to come in, and people genuinely like working together. We've also designed our office for work. It doesn't just look like a big coffee shop. It's actually designed for work, where we have, you know, private two-person offices for, you know, you and your mentee, which you often have because we're scaling quickly. So a lot of our more senior staff's always got a mentee. But yeah, two-person offices, you can close the door and actually get work done. And we cluster really well. You know, people that work together closely, you know, are close to each other. So it's kind of nice just being able to walk over to someone's office and get stuff done, grab a whiteboard. You know, it's a useful office, and I find people want to be there together with people. So for the most part.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I mean, it's a very timely conversation for us as we're sitting here recording our very first episode in the studio in the new Collider co-working space here in Saskatoon. And just the power of community and design and how that plays a role in how people act and interact with each other.
Yeah,
I think is often overlooked, and I'm always impressed with how Siemens and your team has been able to engineer solutions to those problems in really interesting ways. Going back a little bit to the technology piece, so you guys were doing machine learning and AI before machine learning and AI was cool, before it was the new hot thing. We're headed into kind of like a new era of AI right now, where yeah, everybody's talking generative AI, ChatGPT.
Sure.
And things like that. I'd love to get your perspective on that space. And what are the opportunities? Is it all hype, or is this the next platform event to kind of create a new generation of startups and economic growth?
Yeah, a lot of. I think it's a really good general topic. Whenever you hear something that's sort of climbing up the hype curve quickly, it's a good question to ask. Like, is this the next big thing? Because I think usually it's not. You know, most things go through that whole, you know, they climb up the hype curve and they end up at a peak and then they start tumbling really fast. And so what is that? They call it like the trough of disappointment or disillusionment, right? And then sort of come into their normal use and long-term use over time. And you know, we've seen that happen with like VR, right? VR, everyone loves VR. Do you know anyone that wears VR glasses when they're walking around down the street or doing their regular job? Not really, right? Mm-hmm. It didn't take the world by storm. It's kind of a neat entertainment platform or something, but it wasn't like the next big thing like people thought it was when they're investing like crazy in it. And you know, for Solido, we didn't start using machine learning or AI because it was cool. We did it because it was just an algorithmic class of algorithmic tools. You know, we just kind of look at all the tools we have in the software development toolbox, and you know, some of them fall into categories, and you know, they happen to be machine learning AI category of tools that allowed us to give our, you know, 10x, 100x, 1000x, million X speed ups in our space. And it was a superpower, but it wasn't that it was cool at all. In fact, it was so uncool at the time. I mean, AI was the greatest disappointment of the 80s, right? AI was this big thing. We all thought we'd have robot butlers by the end of the 80s, and we didn't. You know, AI was this huge disappointment. If you go and look, there was like horror movies about AI and sci-fi. Everything was about AI in the 80s. Nothing happened, right? It was one of these things that just never, but a lot of the algorithms that are used today and everyone talks about as this brand new cool thing were developed in the 80s, you know, including a lot of the stuff that Solido pulled in and said, hey, this is a useful tool in the toolbox for the problem that we're solving. So no one wanted to hear about machine learning or AI. It was sort of, if you said it, it's sort of like, oh, that's that thing from the 80s that didn't work. Yeah, cool. Whatever, guys. So we didn't talk about it. You know, if you'd say it, people just, oh, why is this nerd still talking kind of thing? No one had the time of day to talk to you about that. And then, you know, 2014, people started saying, oh, wow, this AI is kind of like this neat thing. And people are like, well, I remember that from the 80s. That wasn't cool. Anyway, but 2015, 2016, it was extremely cool, right? If you're not doing AI and machine learning, you're definitely not a startup. You know, like this isn't like you had to put like crypto and machine learning on everything. Machine learning specifically, AI, mm-hmm. not so much. It was machine learning and crypto had to be on everything that you did. And And all of a sudden, that's all people wanted to talk to me about is machine learning and how we have machine learning in our tools. So that was a huge deal. And, you know, we've really, you know, continued to use the same methods that we were using in, you know, 2007, 2008, 2009. We got better at them. What we got really good at is bringing them to market and production tools that people could actually use for solving engineering problems, which is a really complex thing to do. And I think we're still the industry leader in terms of actually having real production machine learning tools for engineering. There's not that many that have successfully reached, you know, full production like we have. So that's something cool. You know, when you're looking at the next thing on the hype cycle, though, you're talking about large language models. You know, ChatGPT is the thing, and large language models. You know, is that a new cool thing? Absolutely. You know, is this the next new platform? I think for some things it is. You know, what you're seeing right now is people are saying, well, what if we put this on everything? What happens? And some of the things are going to be, you know, stupid, and they're going to die off, and, well, that was the wrong thing. But there's going to be a whole bunch of applications that are going to emerge in the next few years. Like, it's happening incredibly quickly right now. There's, you know, 1,000 new, you know, startups trying to use large language models for all kinds of verticals where they've never been thought of before. If you can find a data set, you go and train it and see if that's a cool thing. And then what do you need to do to turn it into a product? And there's just a ton of interest in that right now. So it's going to be one of those things where, you know, 1 or 2% of the things people are trying actually stick, and the rest, the other will be sort of like that. Well, I wasn't the right tool for the job. That's what's happening right now. But those couple of things where it sticks are going to be really important. They're going to, you know, form a, you know, an important part of our future. So it is a real thing. It's not going to be like put it on everything and it's everything you put it on is the right thing. It's most of it's going to be wrong, but a few things are going to emerge as really transformational within, you know, sort of the large language model kind of space. And yeah, I know a lot of people that are talking about trying it on stuff. I'm like, I don't think that's the right thing, but maybe you can try it. Don't spend too much money on that application. But yeah. You know, I think it's almost in the brainstorming phase, prototyping, and we see what matters. But it's important when people are doing that to make sure that it's stuff that solves a real problem.
You know, also. Yeah, I think like when I think of platform events and things like that, it's what actual real world problems can this thing solve that's not just going to make life a little bit easier, but going to make life a lot easier or entirely change the way that you do your job.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, some of those the things that have popped up with Web3 and crypto over the years, and you just have to ask the question, who's this actually for? I don't know, but
it's almost all wrong, wasn't it? You know, like in those cases, it was almost like 99.9% wrong.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like, and amazing that there's going to be like some little shining stars, but not much of it. I think this is going to be, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I think there's going to be more good stuff that comes out of large language models than there was out of like crypto, for example.
Yeah, for sure. It does remind me more of the early days of the iPhone where it was that very exploratory phase. You had the proof of concept type things like the beer on your phone that moved when you moved your hand sort of thing. And just kind of exploring proof of concept. What can this new technology do for us? But those were the early days of people really taking the advantage of the accelerometer in the iPhone to to solve real world problems eventually. And I think I see that a lot more in this new phase of generative AI, where there's a lot of things that are just fun things to play with, but in the back of your head, you can see that there's a true application to this at some point, right?
Yeah. The first application's really homework, right? You know, I don't know if you've heard about this, but like, you know, kids don't do homework anymore. ChatGPT goes and writes all their short story English homework specifically. And, you know, that's, you know, one of the first things where it's just like obviously way better at writing stuff than school kids are. And it's faster, you know, I don't have to do the work and it's way better at it than I am. So, you know, there's some things where it's good. It's good at writing stories about things that are already reasonably well documented on the interwebs, right? But what's it going to do next? What about legal contracts?
Yeah.
You know, this is one that's hard, right? Because you don't want to just start making, you know, if you say, hey, could you add a clause? Could you add a standard NDA clause to this or a standard non-compete or, you know, standard? Okay, sure. You know, I'll generate something and here you go. Does that look good? I don't know. Like, is that stood up in court for a whole bunch of years? Or, you know, it's a little harder, but maybe, you know, with some refinement, I think, you know, medical diagnosis. Do you think that you can do that? Generative medical diagnoses? I've heard stories about, you know, being able to diagnose things way more accurately and quickly than experts can already. And, you know, there's, but you don't want to be wrong. What's the cost of screwing that up, right? Sometimes it's, you know, lives. And so, you know, there's some of these mission critical, this is where I think it gets really interesting, is in high value mission critical, you can't screw up the answer kinds of things. You know, how do you not just take what the algorithm does, but actually productize the result to the point, because you can't just go and train a model and say there is a product, right? Mm-hmm. There's this productization phase, which will take a ton of investment for some areas, but it's still going to produce a product that's remarkably better than anything we have today. And that's where I think the really good startup opportunities are. It's not like the homework writer pro, you know, kind of things. It's, mm-hmm. That's the fart app of LLMs, right? You know, like the beer pourer app or whatever. It's you know, the sort of homework writer pro kind of stuff. It's really in these more specialized areas where, you know, currently, you know, done by high paid professionals. And, you know, if we could replace them with stuff that actually is generative, not just collecting and telling the story, but actually is generative, but is also right enough for mission critical type things that require a professional today. That's where the really high value future stuff is, I think.
Yeah. And I still think it is really important to explore those early things too. Like on the homework writer pro side of it, I've got a stepbrother I was talking to recently. He's going through business school. ChatGPT is something everybody's talking about in his school right now. And you know, having that conversation, saying, you know, by the time that you're graduated and you're out in the workforce, there will be applications that you can take use of in your daily life. And your job's not going to get replaced by AI, but your job might get replaced by somebody using AI. Yeah. So if you're not starting to learn how to play around with these programs now, and learn the benefits of this sort of thing, then you might be behind by the time that you're in industry. And this is the new Microsoft Word, right? And if you have a leg up or some experience working with some of this stuff, it'll give you a big advantage.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I was just chatting with Amit Gupta about this. He was the founder of Solido, still my boss, you know, so many, many years later, and one of my closest collaborators. And we were just talking about this, and we think large language models are going to have benefit first are more of these 10 times accelerator type things. So, you know, it's not going to replace a professional, but it can make them remarkably more efficient at their job. And they still, you know, the human expert still like looks at the result, guides it a little bit, you know, signs off there. That's the completed version. So it's going to be kind of like these, it's going to give birth to a whole bunch of 10X productivity builders. This is what Amit said. I was like, yeah, absolutely. That's step one. And then, you know, there's probably an 80-20 rule there where, you know, to like 100% replace a person is remarkably harder than doing most of their work for them. So yeah, I think that's where the gold rush is right now, is where all the 10X productivity boosts for high value, high value activities, you know. And I think you could whiteboard up, you know, 50 or 100 in an hour. That would, you know, a lot of them would be good. You know, it's sort of the brainstorming phase of this and the prototyping phase. And there's just like a lot of good ideas right now that can be tried, probably that can work in this sort of 10X productivity boost mode initially. And then you turn that into a product, sell that, and then use that maybe to build the eventual, you know, we'll fully automate this someday kind of vision. Yeah. I think full automation's hard, right? We saw that with self-driving cars. Mm-hmm. There's a really difficult application, right? This level 5 self-driving cars without steering wheels that just work, right? It was predicted that incorrectly by lots of people that we'd have that back in 2018, 2019, it was going to go quickly. You know, we got part of the way there. There's definitely some 10X productivity boosts, like, you know, your car does 90% of the steering on the highway now, which is kind of neat. But does it drive itself now? But that, you know, the easy part we kind of did quickly, and now the hard part's left. And I think that's where we're at with LLMs. Can you take that problem that's not so hard to solve, you know, sort of own an area vertical that's high value, solve part of it, you know, substantial part, you know, the 90% of it kind of thing, and leave the rest to humans and make products. Like that's kind of the formula, I think, for large language model based startups.
Yeah. And that's kind of a great segue back to, you know, Saskatchewan and the Saskatchewan tech sector. For founders and people working on problems here today, is this something that they should be thinking about integrating into their products now?
Yeah, you know, it's not as a solution looking for a problem. Mm-hmm. Start with the problem, and if this is the right solution, then good. You can definitely think about, you know, start brainstorming problems that can be solved with this, but don't just brainstorm solutions. Like, I'll bet you we could do something silly that no one needs with LLMs, you know. Like, I think this is where a lot of startups go wrong, is you build something. Not many startups fail from just failing to do any work at all. Like, they work hard and they just build the wrong thing, right? You know, you build something, it's not the right product. It's not something that you can sell to people and at scale. And so, you know, turn it on its head and really think about, you know, what could we solve with this and who are we going to solve it for? And then go validate that and make sure that you're building the right thing for customers that will pay you. You know, that's really where to go with it. It's just, think of it as another tool in the toolbox. And what would I do with that tool for customers who will pay me? Not like, I wonder if this experiment could work or something. I'm not trying to write research papers or trying to build products that people will buy, right? And that's, I think, the really important thing. I think what we do need, this is a challenge here, if Jeff's challenge maybe for our tech sector, is we need more deep tech. You know, Solido, that's actually what made us, right? It wasn't that, you know, we did a software construction project and called it technology. We invented things that no one had ever seen before that solved fundamental problems in the semiconductor industry that, you know, big companies couldn't solve themselves. Big companies with tons of resources and time hadn't solved yet. And I think we need more of a focus on deep tech in the Saskatchewan tech sector. I think people should really try and build businesses around a deep technical nucleus that gives them that 10x differentiation. And this is an opportunity, right? Large language models are an opportunity. There's lots of opportunities, not just this one. There's a whole bunch of different ways that you can build something that's fundamentally differentiated and way better than anything that exists. And I think that's really the call to action for me, because we haven't seen a lot of that. You know, there's been companies that have gotten off the ground, but not with a lot of what I would consider like real deep technological differentiation, and something that we need to really take a lot more seriously, I think, when deciding what we're going to go and invest in as a startup.
Yeah, there you go. Jeff's call to action.
More
deep tech coming out of Saskatchewan. So on that, something like we like to do with the podcast, as you're aware, is make sure that our listeners are able to get in touch with our guests on the show. So if people have questions about how do I integrate deep tech into the problems I'm solving, or I just want to get to know Jeff a little bit better, how can people reach out?
Yeah, definitely. I'm easy to find. My office is right here at Innovation Saskatchewan in 121 Research Drive. I'm happy to have meetings up there. If you want to just email me, Jeffrey, R-E-Y, J-E-F-F-R-E-Y .dyck, D-Y-C-K @gmail.com. Always works. If you do the E-R-Y one, I know the guy really well that's got that email address. He's in Calgary. He forwards me stuff every now and then. Really nice guy for doing that over all the years, but it'll find me too, I think. But just send me an email or shoot me a message on LinkedIn or something. It's and I'm always here, happy to hear from people, and definitely love brainstorming too. You know, if you've got an idea that you want to, you know, shake out, what I love to do is figure out how to actually turn that into something that people will buy, you know, how to turn an idea into a product concept. And that's maybe where I can help the most.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, Jeff, thanks so much for joining us again.
Yeah, pleasure again. All right. Nice digs here too at Collider. Congratulations on the new space. This looks amazing.
Thanks. Yeah, we're excited.
Startupville is brought to you by Innovation Saskatchewan, helping grow the technology and research sector in our province and beyond. Our show is produced by me, Ariel Delorier, and our host, Mike Wolsfeld. Our theme music is from GG Riggs and Reactor Productions. We're moving our social media presence over to the original Innovation Sask channels. Follow us on Twitter to stay in the know at Innovation Sask. Don't forget to review wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps us rise up the ranks. See you next time on Startup Bill.